Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Sheltimer, Chris Cameron, and my co-host Felicity Sitnell-Reed. The approach of Christmas and the holiday season prompts us to make different kinds of programs from our usual ones. It is a season of stories and poems and songs, so instead of interviews with one writer, we've asked a number of writers to read their work for us, including the three of us. Felicity, perhaps we'll start with you.
Well, this story is about a donkey, and the donkey was based on the exploits of a donkey that we had as children for a fairly short time because he turned out to be rather difficult to look after. His start in adventures came about because he took part in Christmas celebrations. It's called Stage Struck. The first snow fell late that year. November was mellow, the sun turning the long grass pinky gold in the morning, the cedars holding their green, and the earth sending up a faint mist through the frost. Edward rolled in his field next to the house and brayed for his summer friends who'd shared his pasture. Alone now, he huddled in his small straw-lined barn on cold nights. I'd inherited Edward from my uncle and aunt when they sold their farm. He became my daughter's pet. But Megan left for theatre college. She came home sometimes on the weekend, but most of the time Edward had only me. I felt sorry for him. He needed company. One morning the phone rang. A voice said, "Hello, I believe you own a donkey, right?" "I do." I carried the phone to the window to check that Edward was safely in his field. He'd escaped in the past and was bored and ripe for mischief. I kept a close eye on him these days. "I'm Ron Green, working with some young people here for a few weeks. I wonder if I could use your donkey in a Christmas play." Visions of Edward bringing the production to a halt, kicking one of the actors off the stage, or escaping, flew through my mind. "Well, he'd probably love it. He likes having a job. But maybe you'd better meet." Ron's voice bounced back at me. "Oh, yes, I'd love to." "What am I doing?" I thought. But a meeting arranged, I told Edward about his possible future. A casting call. What excitement. I rubbed his woolly head. Happy, he took a run around the field before returning to huff gently in my ear. Ron arrived that afternoon. Bundled against the cold, his face was rosy, his eyes bright. In the field, Ron approached Edward, holding out some pieces of apple. Natural friends. I was pleased when Ron offered to collect Edward and bring him home himself from rehearsals. The following week, Edward donned his harness and accompanied Ron to the bright lights of a theatrical life. I heard he behaved impeccably and soon became a favorite. Ron wanted Edward, Mary, and Joseph to make their way to Bethlehem through the streets of the town, gathering an audience on the way to the church. On Christmas Eve, Meg and I went to see the show. Glittering snow showers floated in the light of the street lamps, powdering those who'd come out for the play and the carol service. Mary rode Edward. Proud to carry her, he danced through the snow behind Joseph. When people called out, he turned his head to nod at them, his big ears waggling, his dark eyes seeking admirers. Stuffed sheep had been borrowed from an upscale sheepskin store, and two oxen painted on a backdrop hung over the inner doors to the church, making a stage of the porch. The only live animal, Edward, was a star. The children presented the Christmas story gracefully. Edward was the perfect extra. His head turned to each character who spoke, but otherwise he kept still. Mary and Joseph met the innkeeper. Shepherds pushed through the audience to the church porch. Three shimmering kings carrying brightly painted caskets arrived. The choir sang "O Little Town of Bethlehem," encouraging people to join in. Everyone, including Edward, loved the whole experience. However, in the next month, Edward fled his paddock several times. A danger on the road, both to himself and unwary drivers, two of his capers resulted in police visits late at night. Drastic measures would soon be in order. But finally I did find his escape route. In the far corner of his field, there was a slight hollow where in summer he liked to roll in the dusty grass. Now lying flat, front legs stretched forward and back ones dragging behind, he wiggled his body patiently on the crusted snow until he slid out under the fence into a shallow ditch. Then he kicked up his heels and trotted off down the road. Around the beginning of February, Meg was due to visit, so I called to tell her we needed to strengthen the fence, to bring the wire down to the ground and bury it as deep as the weather would allow. "That sounds quite a project," she replied. "Lucky I'm bringing a friend home. He can help out." When she arrived, I was surprised to find it was Ron she had in tow. First they visited Edward, safely shut in his barn, but then they were eager to talk. "Remember I told you the Lantern Theatre wanted young actors for Spring Awakening, and I got a part? I met up with Ron again, working on the same production. And, see, Mum, we think life will be much easier if we share an appointment." I was shocked. But heroically, I thought, I kept quiet. We worked to make Edward's field secure, and I must say, they laughed as often as they disagreed, working well together. By May, I'd grown accustomed to their relationship. Working in the theatre didn't provide an extravagant lifestyle, but both Meg and Ron seemed to be happy. Unfortunately, I still had major problems with Edward. Our winter repairs had been successful, but I knew Edward was looking for a way out. What if I couldn't keep him at home? Would he end up at the Knackers, turned into dog food? Then I heard the horses we'd boarded in the past were not returning this summer. He was going to be as lonely as ever. In despair, I seriously thought of advertising a donkey for sale. But one night, Ron rang. "Hey, Nina, does Edward like sheep?" "Actually, yes. He guarded some on my uncle's farm. My cousin's got a problem with coyotes and is looking for a donkey to protect her flock. Would Edward like the job?" Shortly after, Edward returned to farm life. We visited at Christmas, wondering if he hankered after his glamorous, if fleeting, stage career. But he seemed happy with his real-life sheep. The next year we couldn't go. We were preparing for a different event. On Christmas Eve, Ron called me to say I'd become a grandmother. Meg was fine, and of course they were calling the baby Edward.
Delightful. Thanks, Felicity.
I believe I'd like to take a turn now with a story about the beloved Christmas carol Silent Night, and how it came to be written. In 1818, on December 23rd, in the little village of Oberndorf, near Salzburg in Austria, the organ at the small church of St. Nicholas wasn't working, and could not be repaired before Christmas. Father Joseph Moore was not a man to just give up, however. Sometime before, he had been walking home over a hill, and had stopped to look down over the peaceful, snow-covered village, and revel in the majestic silence of the wintry night. This scene had prompted him to write a poem about the night when angels announced the birth of the long-awaited Messiah to shepherds on a hillside. He had called his poem Stille Nacht. Moore took his poem to the organist and choirmaster of a nearby town, Franz Gruber, and asked Gruber to write a melody for the poem, to be accompanied on guitar. In several hours, Gruber had the music done. It no longer mattered that the church organ was inoperable. On Christmas Eve, the little Oberndorf congregation heard Gruber and Moore sing their new composition to the accompaniment of Gruber's guitar. Weeks later, well-known organ builder Karl Mauracher arrived in Oberndorf to fix the organ in St. Nicholas Church. When Mauracher finished, he stepped back to let Gruber test the instrument. When Gruber sat down, his fingers began playing the simple melody he had written for Moore's Christmas poem. Deeply impressed, Mauracher took copies of the music and words of Stille Nacht back to his own Alpine village. There, two well-known families of singers, the Reiners and the Strassers, heard it. Captivated, both groups put the new song into their Christmas season repertoire. The Strasser sisters spread the carol across northern Europe. In 1834, they performed Stille Nacht for King Frederick William IV of Prussia, who ordered his cathedral choir to sing it every Christmas Eve. 20 years after Stille Nacht was written, the Reiners took the song to the United States, singing it in German at New York City's Trinity Church. In 1863, 45 years after being first sung in German, Stille Nacht was translated into English, and 8 years later, Silent Night made its way into print in Charles Hutchins' Sunday School hymnal. Today the words of Silent Night are sung around the world in more than 300 different languages. In 1914, during the Christmas truce of World War I, the song was sung in French, English, and German simultaneously. It was the one song that all the soldiers on both sides knew. And to this day, every Christmas Eve in the little village of Oberndorf, where the story began, Stille Nacht is sung. Nowadays, it's broadcast live by webcam, so the whole world can listen to the magical music that first echoed through the forests and mountains of Bavaria over 200 years ago.
Thanks, Chris. And now we'll take a short break.